number 228. Thank you. Nothing new, just hearing what we've been saying in her words. Middle of the page. Now maybe I should go a couple sentences above that. Go up to top of the page, 5 lines down. She appears as if surrounded by a cluster of creative contents pushing into the light of consciousness. And these contents are in danger of being destroyed by the alchemist, presumably because they are incompatible with his conscious attitude or difficult to reconcile with it. So if you want to think, you know, of that little example of that pastor with this child pornography obsession, you can see that was somewhat in conflict with his value system. And the superego wants to get rid of it. And if you do that, if you judge it morally, because it's incompatible with the way you think and the way you feel, then you cut out the possibility of transformation. That's what she's saying here. It is not only the body of the ore, the inferior side of man, which should not be destroyed by too drastic a process of purification, but also his spirits. Now, his spirits would be the meaning of that. It's within that difficult, thank you, in that difficult experience, but also his spirits, and above all, as the text said, his soul.
Your sentence, actually, before the one you read there about the autonomous content, psychologically, they embody the autonomous content of these life forms.
Right.
Well, so these things manifest themselves as independent of anything that the ego brings to the table, so to speak. I mean,
it can be. Sometimes you can see that it's a part of the person's psyche that they've disowned, and sometimes it's an attitude which has never really existed in their civilization. It's trying to come to the fore. This is why Jung talks about the collective unconscious. It's new things are coming up which have never been. Mm. Or if they've been, they certainly have never been in that form. You know, I don't think there's ever been a period in our civilization where there's been a union of matter and spirit. There's been matter, and there's been spirit, but there's never been matter and spirit.
I take that sort of to a theological conclusion. There's never been a time in history before where monkeys have had the opportunity to blow up the entire world through the creation of weaponry.
Exactly.
That's sort of
exactly
crazy.
So, because that's the danger, the psyche is generating attitudes to try to cope with that. And those attitudes have never been before.
Denial still seems to be reigning.
No, to say to cope with it, to deal with it, to find out what the cause is, yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
But isn't it still have any responsibility to the people that are affected by the behavior, though? I mean, with that talking, obviously, I certainly understand it from this point of view.
Yeah.
The archetype doesn't, there's nothing good or bad. It's just that there's no morality in that. It's just what is. I just think about the people who sometimes behavior impact.
Well, fortunately, I could ascertain that nobody was being impacted by that behavior. In fact, was a father. We had 3 little kids. And they drove in. They were not from around here. They drove in. And often his wife would come and they'd use my bathroom, or the kids would go play in the yard or something. And he was a great dad. And, you know, had he been doing anything illicit with his kids, I would have had to blow the whistle. But he wasn't. See, that's the difference. You can see that whether these experiences are hitting somebody who's responsible or somebody who's irresponsible. Now, it could hit somebody who's a jerk, and they're absolutely irresponsible. And then you can't follow this line of approach, because there are other people who are being harmed. Yeah.
Would that same be true for the woman who was anorexic in terms of that it was killing her? I mean, could
you? Yes, in a way you could say that it was certainly hurting her relationship to her kids, too. I mean, they thought her mom was a freak.
Yeah.
But I just didn't see where, I mean, nothing else had worked. I was like her 8th or 9th therapist.
Okay.
Nothing else had worked. She'd been hospitalized. She got out, I think, AMA. And I didn't really blame her. When I heard, you know, she showed me her notebook. Today I ate 3 tarts. Oh, for God's sakes. Is this the best we can do in mental health? Well, yes, I'm afraid it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured try this other approach. Yeah. But yeah, there was hurt being done, but I think in the long run, less hurt was being done by accepting the symptom. The other, next image is the dove. And my soul, or dove, which is without gall, is beauteous and comely. Now, trying to sympathize a little bit. She makes a reference to this guy, I don't know how you pronounce it, Johannes Gracius, I guess, which is on, and that is on page 24. Way back on page 24.
No, 20.
No, page 20. Sorry. Yeah, page 24. What? She says, I've already talked about what the dove is, and this is where she's talking about what the dove is. In the alchemical mind, no. There, see footnote, first footnote, okay, now 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines. There is a resplendent white dove. See where that is?
Mm-hmm.
The footnote.
Mm-hmm.
There is a resplendent white dove called the salt of the metals, wherein consists the majesty of the work. That is that chaste, wise, and rich Queen of Sheba. Now let's pick that apart, because she's giving us the background for how she's going to understand dove. Now the salt of the metals. The salt of the metals would be, first of all, brings us into the symbolism of salt. And to make a long story short, which we can go into a little bit more if you like, but to make a long story short, the salt of the metal would be the essence. So the essence of that metal, now that metal would be the first material, the prima materia, that would be what is symbolized by this emotional state. That is what symbolizes the emotional state. So the metals and the storm and the Ethiopians, it's all the same thing, different descriptions for the initial state. That has a meaning, and that meaning is symbolized by the dove. Nothing new, just giving new images to what we've already talked about. And that's wisdom, you see, the Queen of Sheba. Remember, it's associated with Solomon and wisdom. So it's just another set of images expressing what we've been expressing, that at the heart of these experiences is meaning to be understood. And that meaning is tantamount to a wisdom. And that wisdom comes through an instinctual beginning. And here we have a new set of symbols, salt and dove. So if you go back to our text on 227, we've got again this idea that we're dealing with a garment that is untidy, but it hides a dove. It hides a soul. It hides a meaning. And that meaning is pure. Although its entry in your life is very impure. That's the catch. The reference to gall is important. because that belongs to the symbolism of salt. I'll explain all this. In alchemy, the salt is said to have two meanings, wisdom and bitterness. So, in other words, within this affective state is the possibility of either becoming wise or becoming bitter. In other words, bitterness occurs when a difficult situation has not been understood as to its meaning. So when you meet bitter people, you can think you've met people who not only have had maybe a hard life, but who never understood the meaning of what was hard in their life. In fact, if you sit where I do, it's amazing how some people have been through the most horrendous things. And they're fine. Because they've understood the meaning.
And that's what we just talked about, like, Jung said about suffering, that you can endure suffering as long as it has a meaning.
As long as it has a meaning. And it's when you've been through tough times and you are not able to take the emotions that surround them and transform them, that you become bitter. So, see, the dove would be the meaning side of the salt. And the gall would be the bitterness side of the salt. So, the salt in the experience means that each experience comes to you with the possibility of making you bitter or wise.
Rather interesting, as far as taste is concerned, salt will cut back on bitterness. And think of the phrase, pouring salt in a wound.
Mm-hmm. Salt in the wound and salt of the earth.
And it'll sting like the devil, but it'll help cure it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another combination of the two.
Mm-hmm. She refers here, although I would just pick a little piece of it for you. Without gall means without bitterness, a reference to the symbolism of amaritudo. I'm not sure what that equates to in English. Does anyone know that? It must be Italian, huh? Or that's not Latin, is it? Oh, amari too. Amar must be the mar must be the same as ocean, huh? Must have the same word.
Maybe the word for bitter in French.
Might be the word for bitter in French. I'll check that. It didn't hit me before. Anyway, as discussed by Jung, I just thought I'd read you one sentence where Jung puts this very well. It's in Mysterium Communitionis, paragraph 330. Nothing new, but it's one powerful sentence. Tears, sorrow, and disappointment are bitter. But wisdom is the comforter in all psychic suffering. Indeed, bitterness and wisdom form a pair of opposites. Where there is bitterness, wisdom is lacking. And where wisdom is, there can be no bitterness. I'll read it again. Tears, sorrow, and disappointment are bitter. But wisdom is the comforter in all psychic suffering. Indeed, bitterness and wisdom form a pair of alternatives. Where there is bitterness, wisdom is lacking. And where wisdom is, there can be no bitterness. Mr. Ian Kirkionis? Okay. Yeah, volume 14, paragraph 330.
Paragraph what?
Paragraph 330.
Just the last line.
See, where there is bitterness, wisdom is lacking, and where wisdom is, there can be no bitterness.
Thank you.
That's a big difference, I think. Questions on that? The next image refers us to the psychology of kingship. It's on page 229. For whose love I languish, in whose ardor I melt, in whose odor I live, by whose sweetness I regain my health, and from whose milk I take nourishment, and whose embrace I am made young. That's the key phrase there, I am made young. From whose kiss I receive the breath of life, in whose loving embrace my whole body is lost. If you look down the second paragraph after that quote, the words, in whose embrace I am made young. Deserve emphasis. And that's a reference to the king's renewal. Now, I thought, unless you're all familiar with it, we'd spend a little time on the psychological meaning of kingship. Is that worth doing?
Yeah.
Jung based a lot of his model of the ego and the self on the rites of ancient kingship. In those ancient rites, when I say ancient, I think you could see them, you would still see them in Egypt and in Mesopotamia, but even earlier in Stone Age societies. Hunter-gatherer societies. The king is the boss. And the king is the priest. There's no separation between the religious ruler and the political ruler. And the king rules because of, by virtue of his relationship to God. Of course, in a matriarchy, you could think of a queen. I think the Minoans probably had a queen. And it's important why we're looking at kingship. Now, remember, you're working with a magical level of consciousness. So the people in that living unit, when things went bad, it was the king's fault. Because that was an indication their relationship to God had soured. So they killed him. And they installed a new king. And sometimes they killed him just for the heck of it before the things went sour. So every year, they would have, or every couple of years, I think even maybe every year sometimes, they would kill the king, and they would have a new installation of a new king. Now, Jung took that as a metaphor, as expressing a fundamental human need that the ego, which would be paralleled by the members of the tribe, have a relationship to a superordinate authority, a king. But where that was lived out externally, he thought the basic nature of the human personality was such that it was actually an internal structure that in the first phases of history was lived out concretely. That the ego has to relate to an inner superior value. And that inner superior value has to be in accord with the central core of the personality, the self. Sort of like the king is the representation at any given moment of the values which are from the self that are appropriate to your given stage in life. And he thought that was really the great loss of the founding of America, that we got rid of kingship. Because there's been nothing to take his place. You know, all those dreams that he had, if you've read Memories, about going back to the Middle Ages, he was going back to this problem. How do we go back to that fundamental structure of the personality in which the ego needs to relate to a higher authority? And only in doing so does a human being become a human being. Now, he then tried to work it out subjectively. So that psychologically, the king would represent your value system, and that value system in a healthy person is reflective of the self. And then the ego orients their life around that value system in a healthy personality. But as you can imagine, the demands of life vary from phase to phase. So the values that are right for elementary school aren't right for middle school, aren't right for high school, aren't right for college, aren't right for getting married, aren't right for raising children, aren't right for the empty nest, aren't right for death. So at each phase of life, there has to be a new set of values emerge. So that is symbolized in the dreams by the death and rebirth of the king. So he thought that that's what was being lived out concretely in these early living societies. And just as that is the case for individuals, so it's the case for societies. A society, or the history of a civilization, or the history of humankind, itself goes through different periods. And in those periods, we need a different image of the king, Christ the king, in other words, a different image of God, to convey to us what is necessary for the current historical moment. Like Tom said, 100 years ago, there wasn't the danger of world annihilation. Today, there is. We need different values now, because things have changed. 50 years ago, kids in colleges in America weren't competing with kids in college in New Delhi for technical support jobs. Today, they are. It's a world market. We need different values. So the demands of the time require different value systems to meet the challenges. And so just as an individual needs to go through a death and rebirth of a king, so does a society. And we are now in the period of a death of a king. When Nietzsche says in 1880, God is dead, Jung would interpret that, the values that were working up to that time are no longer appropriate for the next phase of life. And sure enough, what did we see happen in the world stage but the two world wars? Those values of the Victorian society weren't broad enough to help us deal with the complexities of modern life. So when we've got the king in here that wants to be made young again, that would and that's Sophia talking about herself. That Sophia is saying a new value system must be attached to me, because the old way I've been understood hasn't been adequate. And what's the new ingredient? That Sophia is related to the body. And she says that on page 230. Here it is wisdom who wants to be rejuvenated. And from this we must conclude that the interpretation of this archetype hitherto, that is the church's conception of wisdom, was in need of renewal. She became, as we mentioned earlier, something completely abstract. The sum of ideas in the mind of God. Or was interpreted as the art by which God created the world. Remember, that was the passage in Proverbs. Or was simply identified with Christ as the Logos that existed before the world. The feminine element in this personification was, however, overlooked. Too little attention was paid to her anima quality, her specific nature as a connecting, mediating factor, and to the feeling value she contains. Now, by being rediscovered through a primordial archetypal experience, she is, as it were, rejuvenated and comes alive again.
What's running through my mind, and I don't know whether it has anything, is that there's so many differences in the cultures today and where people are. You know, going on.
Right. Well, this would be I think what we're dealing with is the evolution of a myth or evolution of a story. And it doesn't mean that we're ready to move into that. But that doesn't bother the myth. See what I'm saying? It wants an evolution of religious values. And whether or not we can keep up with it doesn't really bother it. That's the way the unconscious is. It produces the images. And then it says, now, you know, if you listen to them, fine. If you don't, I'll find someone else to speak to.
And would that be too like a little African child that was way back in the... That's what I mean. In the world view, we're so, you know, diversified. And does this come like to somebody who is totally background different?
You know, it's hard to say, Mary. I'm thinking probably they already embody it.
From the natural.
From the natural personality, at least to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I believe it's addressing the level of, or the consciousness that is creating world history.
Okay.
The people who are creating world history, because that's where things are at stake. And you know, those of us who want to try to wake up, what you will find in your inner journey is that it puts you in touch with those attitudes. Now, you may not be one of the leaders of the world, but I think it's part of our job to articulate these things for the people who are in powerful positions and who do want to listen to this, which aren't many, but I think there are a few around. Yeah.
I think that we have a lot to learn. You know, in African mythology, it's interesting because in the Christian myth, Christ breaks into time, mm-hmm, with prophecy and revelation. Africans don't think that way.
Right.
They embody God consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so their mythology is always present, always now, always in this moment. They,
yeah,
don't have a God that's coming from somewhere. They did at the beginning, the creating. So what I think is so valuable for us is to look at their mythology,
yeah,
and begin to see that as the embodiment of spirit and matter.
Yeah, I think you'll see the relationship.
Which is just such a lovely thing. So I think it's sort of cross-pollinating each other,
yep,
in this way, and it's coming to us depending on the thread that we are pulling through. Because,
mm-hmm,
you look at those women in Rwanda, an amazing thing that they're doing after all this genocide, because,
mm-hmm,
they believe in this earth and this,
mm-hmm,
God that they... So, and that's the feminine. She,
yeah,
wants to regenerate.
Yeah.
She is not going to get trapped in the past, not going to be worrying about this one woman I saw yesterday, and she watched her whole family get murdered, and then they raped her until they were so tired that she could escape. But she is, life goes on, and we've got children to raise and an earth to take care of, and so they embody it in a way that's very different than what we do. But it's a different level of consciousness.
It's a different level of consciousness.
Theirs is growing as well. But
yeah.
It's just a different way. And I love that we're all sort of, because we're getting global now.
Yeah, and I think that's one of
evolution.
That's one of the features of the new king and of the transformed Sophia, that it's a world consciousness.
And actually, in African myth, they didn't kill the king, but every year he had to be stripped down to nothing. And so the lowliest of the people in the village became his superiors. And they totally stripped him down, and it helped him to understand the role that he played in their life.
Yeah.
And it was at their behalf that he was there.
That's beautiful. Yeah, there are many versions of that myth. I was just giving you kind of a skeleton.
Right.
But Jung did feel it's a powerful, it's one of the most powerful drives in us, that we establish this ability to die and be reborn,
right?
Because we need we need to be new people at new phases, both of our own personal life and the life of our time. You know,
does that also fit with the myth of, as Arthur goes, so goes the land?
See, the Arthurian kingship is based on that fundamental archetype, right? Mm-hmm. Although you can see it's gotten rigid. Because he doesn't die, and he's not reborn. He's a static force. And that was part of Jung's feeling about medieval Christianity. It had become a static force. It wasn't dying and being reborn. But we see in Thomas's psyche the attempt for it to die and be reborn. Yeah.
So there can be regressive qualities to like the Arthurian myth. I mean, the fact he gets on the boat and goes off to Avalon or whatever, and there's always this hope that remains that somehow the return, the king will return, and life will go on, or life will be renewed.
But he'll come back when he's needed. Or is that excellent?
See, I would say that's regression. That's regressive.
Because I think we're seeing that right now in Washington, D.C. We're seeing a dynastic family that's trying to impose a kingship on a country that really set itself up not to have a king, even though they set up a chief executive officer, more on a corporate level. And unfortunately, we're seeing the regressive aspects of this kingship, and it's the kind of horrors that's manifesting throughout the world. I mean, this kind of kingship says that the lives of Palestinian or Rwandan or African or an Iraqi, not worth American life.
Well, he's the okay guy.
And it's Pooler Eternus who happens to have the power to push the button to destroy the whole world.
The interesting follow-up to this is in the Grail legend. Those of you who did that, you should remember. This really has struck me, and I may work on it sometime, but if you think about the Grail story, at the end of it, Parzival finally gets to the castle, and he has to say, whom does the Grail serve? He says that the Grail serves the king. When he says that, the king is healed, and then he dies. See, so in the Grail legend, you've got the death and rebirth. And the way Emma Jung and Franz interpret that is, the religious task is to know what doesn't work. What he has to do is say, whom does the Grail serve? But what the Grail serves is something that's dead. So that what is living in that Grail vessel is no longer feeding what's alive. So before you can have a new king born, you have to know that the old king is dead. And that is part of the problem. Now, in the personal story, when most of us are, you know, working in this business or have gone on our own personal journey, our king has died. And so in a way, you're a step ahead of things if you realize the old pattern isn't working. But there are many people who are absolutely happy with that old pattern. It makes a lot of money, though. That old king is very rich, raping the land and so on. But this whole death and rebirth is very crucial, and one of the crucial things is knowing that the king is dead. Instead of worshiping the old king, saying, well, this isn't working, and I'm not going to pretend it's working, I'm going to look for something else. And I think that's all preparatory to this Sophie experience ever even taking hold anywhere. Lust. 1, 2, 3 paragraphs down on 230. In the text, she says, and in whose loving embrace my whole body is lost. And she spends a little bit of time, just about one paragraph, talking about that. But I think it's very important. And it kind of, in a way, goes to your question, Carol. The reference there is to Philippians 2:6. And as I said, I don't have many Bible passages I like. This is one I really do like. That Jacob and the angel, and when Mary realizes she's pregnant, she says she kept all these things and pondered them in her heart. They're my three favorites. The Philippians 2:6, it's spoken of God, that God emptied himself, taking the form of a servant, so that the birth of Christ, the annunciation, the filling of Mary, is an emptying of God. That's the idea in Paul's letter. So it brings in, it's just one word, but she spends a little time on it. It brings in the importance of emptying into this process of Sophia's transformation. And that is, you have to be able to make yourself empty. God emptied himself. The Annunciation of Mary was the emptying of God into her as a servant. And I think the Greek word is kenosis, if I remember correctly. And there is somewhat of a theology of kenosis. It's a word that you hear in theological circles. Emptying. But see, this business of cooking in the vessel is an experience of emptiness. There is nothing there in your life that's meaningful anymore.
Experience of emptiness.
Emptiness, yeah. And we are so geared to avoiding emptiness. You know, you go on an airplane, you don't have a minute. Peace, there's some movie or there's some music or some food, and if you're really successful, you fly first class, where you get even more movies and even more food and even more alcohol, because God forbid you should sit and be still. And this is what it requires to help this transformation. In that moment when you are cooking in the affect, you have to just feel the emptiness that's in your life. Because it's only in that emptiness that the new thing can emerge. It's very difficult because our tendency is to want to get busy. One of the reasons, I think, why Jung went to the East so much, because there you really do have emptiness as an art. Just think of those Oriental paintings that are so basically empty. And the figure of the human being against the backdrop of nature is minuscule. So it's a very important part of it. And what she felt, that being lost was referred to, and it's also part of the symbolism of the moon, because the moon makes itself dark. So you could say that the feminine part of the meaning of the feminine is the ability to allow oneself to go through periods of emptiness. You want to chew on that, or do you want to go on to it? We have about 5 minutes. Do you want to go on to another point? It's quite a bit, maybe, huh? Mm-hmm. I kind of tell my mind starts saying, "Oh, I'm tired." Mm-hmm. You know, I don't want to give anybody indigestion, but I want to make use of our time.
Yeah. Oh well, it seems to me that again, it's suffering, which is, you know, sort of a religious thing. And mm-hmm. It seems like if you have to go through emptiness, it's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's interesting. It takes those religious precepts, which I think are largely perverted, and it finds a new meaning for them. I think suffering is important, but not the way, by the time you get done with the Catholic Church, it's just flat out masochism. But it doesn't mean that there is not such a thing as genuine suffering, and how do you recognize the difference?
Yeah, I don't like suffering.
Well, neither do I, Mary.
I just never.
You know what? I keep fighting. My life doesn't care.
Parents listening, Jim Hollis on this journey to call our lives.
Uh-huh.
And there, he's at a workshop, and he's talking about, you know, one's destiny and misery and suffering. And this woman stands up and says, "Well, I'm perfectly happy. Why would I want to do any of what you're talking about?" And he says, "Well, maybe your destiny is not to be happy."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's trying to frame a bigger perspective for life. Not that happiness isn't important, it really is, and fun and so on, but what do you want to get out of life? Do you want to retire in Florida and play golf, or do you want to live meaningfully till the end of your life, creating and generating and participating in events and offering the world the bounty of what you've accrued?
Could you equate emptiness with boredom? And here I'm thinking that we don't let our children be bored.
Yeah, it's...
That's a practice for this emptiness you're going to feel later in life. But there's something somewhat familiar about them when it shows up. But if we never allow that loneliness or boredom or all those things in our natural part of the human condition, if we try to emphasize them with busyness and too much, or worry, worry because you're bored, instead of just looking at your child and saying, "Well, there it is."
Mm-hmm. Hard to say, boredom and emptiness. I think they're close, they're like cousins, but I think you can be empty and not bored.
I agree, but I think sometimes emptiness starts in the form of boredom because you realize the things that have brought you, that you're energetically attracted to, you no longer are.
Mm-hmm.
And so it starts to feel like boredom until you realize that it's emptiness.
Yeah, but certainly, you know, our sort of culture of distraction, it's terrifying of this non-being. Mm-hmm. And yet that is so crucial for this process of transformation. Mm-hmm. Because as we'll see, what eventually comes to you is given to you. And you can't receive it if you're too busy. Mm-hmm.
Okay, you know, again, I'll paraphrase it, that restlessness begets meaninglessness, which is soul sickness for our time.
Hmm.
And to me, the boredom is that restlessness, that sense of I don't want to be still. I can't be still. But, you know, maybe there's something that's going to come. There's almost an avoidance. So I just keep
and a feeling that you're doing something wrong if you're feeling it.
Yeah.
If you were an okay person, you wouldn't be feeling this.
Yeah, mine often is something new is just the agitation that almost always makes me restless. Like, I need to get into my productivity.
Well, we've gone through page 231. Looks like we're doing about 8 to 10 pages a meeting. Yeah, I said finish chapter six. I think, you know, suit yourself. What's chapter six? 244, finish chapter six, which is 243, and we are on page... Yeah, we might get a little past that. We might get that far. You can always read a little bit ahead in case. Sometimes you'll find we do hit spots where you can go a little faster because you've heard it before. Okay, see you in two.